All right, so you're listening to this podcast right now, London is Blue, and guess what? We host our podcast on anchor.fm. That's right. If you're looking to host your own podcast, this is the easiest free way to get started. It's got a content creation tool, allows you to record and the podcast right from a phone. That's right. Don't even need a computer, but you can do it there too. They'll also help you distribute it, which is probably the most challenging part. You don't want to have to mess with that. They got you covered. You can get it right on a Spotify and Apple Podcasts, as well as any other place podcasts are found. And you know what? You can monetize it too. Make a little cash for sharing your great content with the world. It's everything you need to make a podcast all in one individual place. So you know what? Head over to your app store, download the Anchor app, or head to anchor.fm to get started if you're ready to launch your podcast and make it happen.
Hi, this is Ruben Loftus-Cheek.
I'm Pat Nevin.
I'm Mason Mount. You're listening to the London is Blue podcast.
All right, Chelsea fans, welcome back to another episode of the London is Blue podcast. As always, your host Brandon, joined by Dan and Nick. Gentlemen, we have part two of the season review. I saw that Chidge did two parts to their season review, so that was probably a minimum 5 to 6 hour commitment. Nick, I'm I definitely haven't gotten through it yet.
7, 12, 19 hours. Those guys love a long show. They do.
It's the Lord of the Rings equivalent of a Chelsea podcast.
The trilogy. Review.
Yeah,
it's probably long enough. So yeah, today we're gonna be talking about awards like Player of the Season, Most Improved, and so many different things. And we'll look back at our preseason predictions, assuming you have time, fingers crossed. So to continue in our season review, we have at Chelsea Youth back with us. Phil, welcome back. Really excited to have you here. Is again, there's such an academy connection to this team. It makes sense to have you here.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me back again. It's been quite a season, and it'll be good to finish it off with a few of these awards and see what went well and what didn't.
Yeah. We are no holding back here. We're going for it. So since this is part two, we don't have any new Patreon or Apple Podcast review shout outs. So just continue to please subscribe on YouTube, watch it there, and check us out on social media, because that's where a lot of these conversations are going to be happening. So end of season awards. Apparently, Dan, you wanted to start it big. You just wanted to not tease the people, no buildup. Your player of the season right away. They're going to just exit after this one.
I mean, look, it's not, you don't have to do that. You could pick another one out of the list.
No, I mean, come on. That'll get way too confusing. So let's hear it. Your player of the season was Azpilicueta for me, Mason Mount for Dan, Azpilicueta for Phil and Nick.
Mason Mount is my player of the season.
So we're split 50-50 between Azpi and Mount. Interesting, Dan. Why Mason Mount?
Well, I don't think, and it's a tight one. I think there's actually good shouts for a lot of players this season. You know, Tammy carried us the whole first half of the season, gets almost 20 goals. You know, in his first full season at Chelsea. Pulisic had an amazing kind of run of form, both in the first half and then the post restart era when he wasn't injured, that led us to doing really, really well. But I think if you're available to be called into action in 54 appearances over the course of a season, you add in 8 goals, you get 5 assists, you played in three to four different roles, you're asked to do pretty much anything. I get why people see Kovacic as an example of a player that they point to. I know that some people were very unhappy with our player ratings about Kovacic. I can't be bothered. I when push came to shove and Frank needed to trust someone this season, it was always Mason Mount. And, you know, yes, he did have a couple occasional bad games, but on the whole, was, I think, one of the brightest spots of the season that we had, Nick.
Yeah, I mean, tireless commitment. I think I am probably grading him on a little bit of a curve, to be fair, because of the step up that he took from the championship. Regardless, he played well this season. Is there a lot he can work on? Will he get better in the next 2 to 3 seasons? You can bet your sweet ass he will. But for when I think of this one, this award to me is an encapsulation of like, who am I going to remember from the 2019-2020 Chelsea season? And the first name on my team sheet is going to be Mason Mount out of that. So that's why it's my pick.
All right. Well, I call them, you know, kind of Mr. Consistency in a season of inconsistency, you know, for Azpilicueta. Just the fact that he was an experienced player, you know, usually a 7 out of 10. Sometimes we had some glimpses, had, you know, the assists. He was up there as well. But Phil, what about you? Stood out for Mr. Azpilicueta?
I think he upheld the higher standards of play more often than anyone else. I mean, Dan and Nick both quite easily could talk me into changing my vote to Mason Mount. It was very close between those two. And I think you could make a convincing-ish argument for Pulisic if you really wanted to, because of how influential he was after the restart. But just on balance, I think Azpilicueta recovered from a struggling first month of the season to generally play really, really well in all phases of play. And I think he was particularly underrated in his ball progression later in the season. It wasn't any of the centre backs who were really leading the passing. It was him coming inside from right back and doing a lot of the midfield job for them. So I think on balance, he deserves that recognition.
Yeah, I mean, he was the captain all season, obviously, filled that role. I mean, I think there, you know, he's not the perfect captain, but in this team, I think he does a really good job of holding players to a high level, but then also keeping the team bond there. And so just with it being such a transitional season, I felt like that was it. But totally can understand the Mason Mount shouts with the excitement and the energy and the tireless effort and his commitment to the cause and being just so Chelsea through and through. I mean, there's really no wrong answer except cap off. So goal of the season. I had Mount versus Wolves. Dan had Bakayo Tomori versus Wolves. Actually, I just wrote that wrong. It was Fick versus Wolves. No, sorry. Free kick, end of the season. I lied. Tammy at Arsenal for Nick and Mason Mount versus Aston Villa for Phil. So we'll go in reverse order, Phil. Mr. Mount at Villa. Why was that one such a standout for you?
I'm a bit of a sucker for volleyed goals, and this was a really, really nice goal. It sort of just kissed the crossbar as it went in. Full on the volley, Matthew Harding end. And it was also quite satisfying because I spent the entirety of that first half wanting Mason to get a little bit closer to Tammy, because there were opportunities there for the two of them to link up. And very early in the second half, William pings the cross in from the right. Abraham just chests it off to Mount, and he finds the roof of the net with a spectacular volley. I don't think you could ask for very much more there.
All right, going in reverse order, continuing. Nick, Tammy at Arsenal. You love a Tammy goal.
It's my favorite goal of the year. I mean, everyone knows how much I love beating Arsenal. To beat them on a counterattack in the 87th minute or whatever it was, after he did all the work to get down there, and then William kind of played a difficult ball to him for him to steady himself and then nutmeg the keeper on the way, and just to see the away fans that are right there, you know, on that, because they reposted it today with the fixture release. So we're recording this on Thursday the 20th, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, it just, it's chills, man. I loved it. It's my favorite goal of the year.
I love that. That's such a fun one. Dan, what about you? You had Fick versus Wolves.
It's a screamer. Perfectly placed, great run up. It just, you know, for those who are watching on television, you know, you see the ball just kind of slowly rolling, and you're wondering who's the runner aim going to be, and you just see Tomori just blow it. It's absolutely uncorks, and yeah, I mean, that whole match was really fun, just to see kind of our youth players, Tammy, Mount, and Fakai all get on the sheet that day. But yeah, I don't know. It was super exciting, and especially considering Tomori's kind of just disappearance in the second half of the season. I think I'll remember his first half more fondly.
Well, without a doubt, obviously. So me with Mount versus Wolves, it was such a clutch goal in a time when we really need it to secure top four. So I just felt like, at the beginning of the season, still playing pretty free, not a lot of pressure, enjoying it. This was like a clutch time. It was coming to the end of the season. We knew we needed a result to clinch top four. And so for Mount to kind of step up in a pressure moment, I thought I was really proud to see that. I'm really excited for him as well. So I kind of added in the weight of the situation to that as well. But I mean, look, I can't wait to get the gifs and the cliffs and the and the clips of all the goals that people are going to vote for on this, because there was a lot of really cool ones. We didn't even talk about the Reece James versus Ajax. That got a lot of love too. But to each their own, and that is okay. What about best match of the season? So I had the Wolves 2, Chelsea 5 match, even though it wasn't in my goal of the season. Dan had Tottenham 0, Chelsea 2. Nick had the United FA Cup semifinal win. And Phil also had Tottenham 0, Chelsea 2. So Dan, I'll go to you and then Phil, because I want to hear you guys' answers about this. I mean, why in the world would you care if we beat Tottenham away?
Well, extra sweet for a lot of reasons, right? Frank Lampard beating Mourinho is fantastic. The energy and the post-celebration. I was watching back the Coming Home documentary that the club put out and just seeing the post-match reaction again and the players kind of walking through the Tottenham Stadium in the tunnels afterwards and how excited it was for them, what it meant for them. Frank's narration about what it's like to be like, yeah, of course I was going to celebrate because they were celebrating. Was all fantastic. And just, you know, seeing the nicest guy in football, Son get a red card, just obviously there's so much. There was so much narrative in that. And then you get William with two goals. Come on. Like, that was the perfect type of, like, for people who don't want to enjoy Chelsea winning because they have an objective or a narrative at times, Phil, this was like the perfect match to kind of like tick every box for, like, annoying people who kind of have an agenda against William or things of that nature. Like, it was just a proper like Chelsea dust up.
Yeah, it was everything you said is spot on. Beating Tottenham is always a reason to celebrate. But I also felt that this match was as complete a performance as Chelsea put in all season. They changed to a three at the back for this match. They absolutely nullified anything Tottenham could do. And Lampard outcoached Mourinho, which I don't think many people would have expected of him so early in his Premier League debut season. It was brilliant from start to finish. They controlled the game. They made a good Tottenham team look ordinary. And I think that's sort of the benchmark that Lampard wants to aim for every single week next season.
Well, I mean, again, nothing to argue with what you guys said. Nick, leaving it late in the season for the FA Cup semifinal win over United. Why was that special for you? Because they didn't do the quadruple over us?
Well, that was helpful, yes. But I agree with Phil that I think in the league, Tottenham away might be our most complete performance. I think it was only trumped by our performance against Manchester United in the semifinal. United had nothing in that game. There was nothing doing. Chelsea obviously got lucky with a bit of a deflection in from Kepa on Mason Mount's effort, but otherwise controlled the game, controlled the passing angles, made life hell for Harry Maguire, and didn't allow much. You know, leaky defense didn't allow much from Greenwood or Martial or Rashford or any of their attackers that had given us grief. Yeah, just, you know, in a semifinal to have a huge performance like that, amazing. Obviously, it would have been better if we would have won the damn thing. But, yeah.
Well, getting to Wembley, especially with that, was such a big one. Probably winning it would have been probably all of ours. But that didn't happen. I went with the Wolves 2, Chelsea 5, because that was really, for me, like the breakthrough for the Cobham crew. Seeing the confidence of Mason, Tammy, and Fick all scoring, beating a good Wolves side at that time too, seeing a lot of heart. It was a shootout. We're like, all right, we'll take 5-2s all season. Unfortunately, we did concede 2 a lot of the time. Didn't always score 5. So, but for me, just seeing those young guys get the confidence in that match, I think that really propelled most of them to having a very successful in their own standards rest of the season. So, just love seeing that. If we can go ahead and flip it, though, to worst match of the season, because why not? Phil had Sheffield United 3, Chelsea 0. Nick had Bournemouth at home. Dan had Chelsea 0, Bournemouth 1. I had West Ham in July, maybe Everton 3-1 in December, or, you know, maybe in the times United beat us all season, twice in the league. To me, it was really like the West Ham 3-2 right at the end of the season. We needed points. West Ham weren't doing great, and we just couldn't get over the line, couldn't stop a goal to save her life. And it was just, again, as it got to like the end of the season crunch time, that one was a huge thrashing. But to see Duncan Ferguson just roll us in his first match against Everton, like that was, I was not a happy camper like most of you after that one. So anyways, Dan and Nick, Bournemouth. You guys have an agenda against Bournemouth. I mean, Dan, what's your deal? Eddie Howe left. Get over it.
I'm happy that we're relegated. Have to play them again in the Premier League. Just they've been such a weird bogey side, and I am super happy that we will not be going to AFC Bournemouth away or inviting them into Stamford Bridge. Low energy, low intensity, crappy goal in the 84th minute, I think.
That overhead miss.
Yeah, it was stupid. It was a stupid match. I want to banish it to the annals of history and never kind of think about Bournemouth playing us again ever.
Yeah, done. I mean, my creative director was over for Chelsea Southampton on Boxing Day, which was almost as bad, but at least Southampton are a semi-serviceable team. Bournemouth are awful, and the away match, the away draw, might have been even worse if we hadn't rescued that thing. Because God, I mean, we couldn't play against them. I have no idea why, but man, it's just a terrible, terrible, terrible result at home.
All right, Phil, over to you. You had the Sheffield United 3-0 towards the end of the season there.
Yeah, that was a desperate performance where absolutely nothing was up to scratch. It all started with the attitude and. It went downhill from there. We know that Sheffield United are a very accomplished team this season. You know what you're going to have to do when you go and play them, especially away from home. And everything that you didn't want to see came out in that match. I'm not going to suggest there wasn't a tactical plan, but it definitely wasn't executed properly. There was no semblance of a midfield. Anyone who was playing up front was hopelessly isolated. And the sooner we can forget about that performance, the better, because it was really ugly.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And again, right at the business end of the season, and we needed something and got the opposite of what we needed. All right, so there's some different ones here. So unsung hero of the season. So that was kind of an interesting way to phrase it, too. Because we still have comeback player, best, worst post-quarantine hair, most Chelsea thing, the Chelsea this season. But to have an unsung hero, that you know, they don't really get the limelight. They don't get the praise. So to have some of the answers that we have made me interesting, especially Dan with you. You had Olivier Giroud. He's a striker. When do strikers not get the credit when they score goals? How is he unsung for you? Talk me through this.
Yeah, Dan. Tell us.
Well, I mean, no one compliments his beard and his hair game enough. I really think we're under complimenting the grooming technique that he puts on a day in, day out basis.
Probably world class,
best hair. Best hair we've had at the club since Alvaro Morata. You know, so I mean, that's saying something.
Cause wasn't that hair. Never that, moved. That was a helmet, as we discussed.
Never moved. Look, I think for all the plaudits we gave him for scoring the goals, I just think from an unsung hero standpoint, for the willingness to ride the bench, the willingness to tough out the first half of the season, which did not go the way that I think he would have hoped he wanted. You know, he's definitely someone who wants to start, who wants to play, who wants to contribute goals, to find a way back into the side, but you know, a little bit through injury and a little bit from forced selection, ends up being our fourth highest goal scorer in the Premier League, his best season since 2016-17 in the Premier League. And does it on really what was a half a season. And part of that was post-restart too. And so I think, you know, there were plenty of people who were firing on all cylinders before the break and did not find their form again in the set, you know, when we resumed the season. And for him to basically be iced for the majority of a campaign and then come back in, like, I just don't think we're saying enough good things about him. That's why I put it there.
So he's been given good things, but not enough good things.
Exactly.
Understood. I was surprised he didn't really go into the fact like his link up play and his selfless running and, you know, the fact that he's a striker who doesn't score a lot of goals but helps the team. But hey, you do you over there, Boo. All right. We're going to keep moving because Nick, you all right there, boss? Did you see what you put in the script here?
Yeah. Okay. Marcus Alonso?
Yeah. Alonso.
Yeah.
Okay. Hero was hero. The title in the.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, talk there. Let's
got it. Got it. Yep. I don't, you know, part of this is expectation setting, right? So I don't think a lot of people would have expected Alonso to play as much as he did this year, given that Emerson had an amazing preseason and, You know, you have the option for Dave at left back, you know, if you need to pull the emergency cord there. He ended up playing a ton, and not just because we transitioned to a back, you know, four or five, whatever, throughout the season, but he came up with really crucial goals. And I think when you think of the Tottenham performances, you think of his away performance at Bournemouth that, you know, he basically saved us on his own. You think of some of the crucial assists in the Champions League. He really stood out to me as a guy who wasn't given a whole lot of credit, still is very, very controversial within the Chelsea community, but for the most part stepped up. Does he have the odd bad game? Of course. Is he not still a true left back? Absolutely. But given what he was given this year, I believe he is an unsung hero of this team.
Obviously, I was stacking the deck against you before you got to it, but I think you have a lot of good points there. I think that Alonso, you know, has continued to force his way into the team for the third straight manager, whether or not we really thought he'd be there or not, and he's adapted again. So, you know, yeah, kudos to him. I'll keep mine short. I had Aspie. Mainly I was looking for a defender or a midfielder because usually they're the ones who tend to get overlooked. Goalkeepers get shutouts. Strikers get goals. There's a lot to be lost in the middle. But our midfield was really inconsistent and not great. So, again, just going with Aspie, the fact of all the chops and changes. But his assists, the amount of productivity we got from him as a right back was extremely impressive. And
please say his real name. No, nope. Please do it.
And,
real name.
I don't think touched on enough in the media as far as like the top right backs that were in the league this season. So that's where I went with Aspie, assist P, if you want to shorten it up. Mm. Phil, I don't even want to steal your thunder on this one because no one can do this justice except you. Let's be honest.
Yeah, my unsung heroes for the season are representative of a cast of hundreds or in thousands, really, because the academy as an operation might be headed up by Neil Barth and Jim Fraser, but the delegation to all of the staff throughout and then the families and everybody else connected to the players, we had 13 academy graduates represent the club at the first team level this season. The leading scorer, Tammy Abraham. Most appearances, Mason Mount. Whichever way you want to cut it, this season was heavily influenced by the academy. So you've got Neil Barth, you've got Jim Fraser, who's very, very, he may be officially titled as assistant academy manager, but he's very, very involved in everything. He's particularly takes the lead on recruitment for 9-16s. And the third name that I wrote on the script was Darren Grace. And Darren Grace is head of local recruitment. So he's primarily responsible for bringing in the players, the youngest age groups, 6s, 7s, 8s, and 9s. And all of the core boys that represented Chelsea this season started in that youngest age group as under nines, and they've been on the journey right through to the first team. So it's more representative of the whole academy, but Neil Barth, Jim Fraser, Darren Grace definitely deserve a shout out.
Well said, sir. I knew you'd do it. Just such a softball for you on that one, obviously. Don't know if that translates to you, but essentially it's like a layup or an easy hit. So comeback player of the year. One that I struggle with because the comeback assumes they had a bad season last year, better season this year. So I still don't know. Live fumbling of me right now. Phil had Giroud. Nick had Willian, Dan had Zuma, and I just couldn't come up with anyone like this. So I guess I want to hear from you, Nick, like what made Willian a comeback? And maybe kind of your guys' context will help me pick one because maybe I'm too nice on people. Maybe that's my problem.
Yeah, that's your problem.
I don't think Willian had a bad year last year, but it certainly wasn't as good as this year was for him. I mean,
it doesn't help sitting in that Eden Hazard having his best season shadow.
Yeah, right. So, like, maybe I'm a little bit off on my guide here, but I think for Willian, his last season at the club, wearing the number 10 finally, crucial in the way that Frank wanted to play with a high press, and I think gave everything he had to the club, even though, you know, it was clearly not going to be a thing that he extended past the season. I'm happy for him. I'm happy that he finally broke 10 Premier League goals in a season for the first time. I think he was crucial in the Champions League run, in the group stage at the very least. And he was someone that Frank counted on all year and was a leader and captained us a couple of times too. So maybe not the best comeback shout, but just a minute to wax poetic on a guy who we've had an up and down relationship, we'll say.
Yeah. And I mean, credit to him. The rest of the group, Nick, before you joined, we were talking about how, you know, when David Luiz was sold, we had questions like, William and him are very close. We know the Brazilians are a tight clique. He was unbelievably professional and committed to the cause all season too. So if for knowing that talks aren't going well, this is like classic time to throw a fit for these top players, you know, when things are going well. And he didn't. He actually overperformed in some areas. So, I mean, he probably needs some recognition. So maybe this is the one. Dan Zuma, is this a literal comeback that you weren't on the team and now you are?
I think it's both. I think he had a pretty horrific injury. And, you know, after that, goes on loan to Stoke City, goes on loan to Everton, which is crazy to think about that it's been, you know, there was a point in time where he was playing next to John Terry and you were like, in, you know, 2016, you're like, okay, cool. This is going to be fantastic. This is going to be the guy that we're going to entrust to be our number two as we move forward. And, you know, that went really south. And yeah, Zuma wasn't necessarily the whole defense was, you know, a bit of a problem area this season. But I think at the tail end of the Project Restart era, Zuma was the one reliable, no-nonsense defender that was going to kick it out of bounds, was going to try to find a way to not put us under any extra or undue pressure, because he maybe like most of us didn't trust that if you let the ball land, that maybe it would be handled appropriately. So, I mean, coming back in, finding his way to be, I think, what most people would define as like our number two. So whomever else we bring in would really, you know, Zuma is like the partner potentially to that person in most regards, I think is really nice to see.
Hmm. All right. Well, literal and figurative. He's still only 25. I think he's getting younger, honestly. Phil, you had Olivier Giroud as your comeback player. I think I have some ideas where you might go with this, but I'm going to let you tell the story.
Yeah, he essentially had one foot out of the door in January. He went to Milan for talks to Inter. Everyone presumed that his time at the club was over. And to be honest, most people were pretty happy with that. I wouldn't, well, maybe not happy, but they were accepting that his time at Chelsea had come to an end. And I don't think anyone really foresaw that he would be the team's leading goal scorer after the restart and would be so integral into securing Champions League football for next season. So from starting 2020, almost leaving the club, to finishing it as a player who many people would be happy with leading the line on occasion next season in a rotation with Tammy and Tina Werner. Can't really complain with that. I think he's done really, really well. He's been ultra professional and it's credit to him.
Yeah. So we've got Dan with the literal comeback and now we've got Phil with the comeback within a single season. so I guess that just leaves Ruben Loftus-Cheek for me, because if there's one person who has come back time and time again after injuries, it's him. I know he didn't feature a lot, especially, you know, did get some minutes in the restart time, but credit to him. These are serious injuries. There's nothing fun about rehabilitating an injury. I've done it. I broke my leg. He's done that type of rehab plan many a times over. And so credit to Ruben for just coming back physically, mentally, and emotionally. And getting rewarded some minutes at the end of the season. Obviously, we all have massive hopes for him. Kudos to Ruben. All right, so here's a little 1-2 punch for you. Best and worst quarantine hair. So I'm going to need two names for everybody. The first name is going to be best. The second one is worst. So instead of spoiling the surprise, Nick, I'm going to let you tell me who your best and worst were.
My best and worst is one entry. It's Mason Mount's facial hair upon return to the league. Once clean shaven, our baby boy has started to sprout hairs on his chinny chin chin. Now, having had that look in college myself, I can tell you,
ugh.
I look back on those photos and It was a poor choice. I think Mason someday will also feel that way as he graduates to a fuller beard. But you know, it was entertaining while it lasted. I would just recommend that he does whatever Eden Hazard did and get that full thing going.
He's gonna need something. He's got a little to work with. Just needs a little bit more. Dan, what about you for your best then worst?
Well, I teed it up earlier, so no surprise that Drew gets a compliment here for just somehow seemingly looking like he always has a professional hairstylist around him, or it is his undercover job that he does at nights when he's not a professional footballer. The worst quarantine hair, without a question, on the team has got to be Jorginho. It was awful. That mop was terrible.
Yeah, it connected to his face, which was the problem. But isn't Olivier Giroud's like wife like into like hair and like esthetician and stuff? Like, I feel like he has to
make a commitment though to it too. He might have said it in jest. Look, he could potentially benefit from a partner does that, but he has to also make the commitment to style.
Yeah,
that's a routine, baby. Do you guys also remember N'Golo Kante's actual hair?
Stop it! That's mine. All right, you're muted. Best post quarantine hair was N'Golo Kante. That was amazing. I mean,
it's just like a little volume. Lego.
It had height. You're like, who was that? You like didn't recognize him. It was amazing. It was like a disguise. And obviously, I have Jorginho for the worst hair ever. That was. The fact that he let that stay the entire time was just so bad, especially when you look at season review videos and you saw how tight that fade was and how clean it was and stuff in the beginning of season. Phil, he just let himself go, did he not?
Yeah, he really did. There's the look good, feel good, play good. And I think everything that was going on with Jorginho at the time was the complete 180 opposite of that. He didn't look good, he didn't feel good, and he wasn't playing good. The other end of the scale, I've got Giroud as the best hair. He is the most handsome man in the Premier League, and he has those standards to uphold.
Yep. That's pretty much was an Olivier Giroud award, let's be honest. How about this? The most Chelsea thing that Chelsea'd this season. I apologize for you that are not English speakers natively. What is the most Chelsea thing that Chelsea'd or did this season? Mine was the roller coaster. Win, then we're going to lose, then we're going to win, then we're going to win, then we're going to lose, then we're going to win. Just no consistency. There was no 17-match unbeaten streak like under Antonio Conte. It was just frustrating in that sense. Phil, I like how you had to call out one match. You're able to just summarize when we Chelsea'd it into one point.
Bournemouth. Yeah, we spoke about it earlier. I think everyone goes into matches against Bournemouth expecting the worst, and Chelsea delivered on it yet again. And okay, the performance away in the 2-2 draw wasn't particularly good, but the defeat at home with a farcical overhead kick winner with Kepa in no man's land and a VAR review that went on forever. I think I've got nothing against Bournemouth, but I certainly won't miss playing them again next season.
I don't think too many fans are going to be bummed to not make it over there this season. I don't think that's going to happen. Dan, what about you? What thing did Chelsea this season?
Well, it's the same as yours. I just framed it in a different way. It's the yo-yo effect. You know, that we were really good in particular matches. You know, let's go beat City. And then, let's go lose to West Ham. You know, it just was super infuriating at times to not have the consistency that was required to make the end of the season land a little bit easier. So I look forward to more consistent results in the 2020-21 season.
Got it. Nick, you, as the finale to this one, have brought the fireworks.
I did. Chelsea, in the Champions League away at Ajax, come up looking amazing, right? We all remember the last-minute Batshuayi winner. We stifled them at home. Tomori plays excellent. Christian Pulisic with an assist, a pool assist, if you will. Then the return fixture at Stamford Bridge completely shit the bed in the first half. And, Ziyech puts one off the bar and subsequently Kepa's face for a goal. We go down big. A double red card gets us back in the game.
It's the most wild thing I think I've ever seen.
It's absolutely insane. Reece James levels. Dave hits the winner, except I watched the replay again. An incredibly dubious handball call on Tammy Abraham that he wouldn't have known anything about because he's looking the other direction. Takes the goal off the board. We draw that one 4-4 in the most ridiculous match of the season. That is as Chelsea can be right there.
Yeah, that's actually quite fair. I'll concede that one. What about the most intoxicating moment? The time that made you weak in the knees, took your breath away, just swept you off your feet. Dan, speaking of sweeping people off their feet, what did you have?
So the way you frame that is fantastic. You said some really interesting things this episode.
I'm on fire. You're welcome.
It's stitches. So mine is the only one that doesn't actually end with a goal, but I think it is a highlight that I will remember. Was Kurt Zuma basically going the full length of the field, dribbling the ball, and in the Champions League, was quite mighty, and you know, just had some incredible step overs and some dodges, and yeah, which was great. Like, it's not what you're expecting to see, but it just shows you that football is crazy and can surprise you at times. You know, I think goals happen from other people. That was a pretty special thing to see from Kurt, Nick.
I think that might be the winner of this group, to be honest with you. I love that moment so much. Pulisic's hat trick to me is something I'll never forget. It genuinely kind of, I mean, he was playing well up into that point, but it kind of came out of nowhere, especially against a Burnley team who we expected to kick the crap out of us like they normally do, and kind of effortlessly glided past them in this one, and Pulisic had a lot to do with that. Obviously, a lot of pride in him and you know, his ability to do that, first player since Clint Dempsey back in the day as an American.
Yeah, that was huge for his confidence. We knew he could play in the league. I mean, no, like, if you can do it against Burnley, you can pretty much do it against most teams in the league.
A cold winter's night in Burnley.
Yeah. I also had Pulisic too. Just his breakout during the restart, becoming the man. The amount of pride and excitement that filled me with was amazing, because he was doing well, then he got injured, and you're like, all right, well, we'll see what happens when he comes back. But for him to be so damn good, you're just like, the left wing is his. All right, we're building around him. That was super exciting. For obvious biased reasons. Phil, you had a very intoxicating moment.
Yeah, I've gone for Reece James's equalizer against Ajax in the craziest game of the season. It was just, the Stamford Bridge was rocking at that point. We'd just come back from however many goals down. His goal was follow-up for a shot that just hit the crossbar. It was a complete swing in emotions. And one of the moments that will stay with me for a long time from this season is him knee sliding in celebration in front of the Matthew Harling stand, being mobbed by a significant number of other academy graduates. And it wasn't necessarily a moment that they'd all arrived, but this was them performing on the big stage, and something that a lot of us have been waiting a long time to see.
Yeah, that's his passion, because he's a reserved guy, couldn't control it, couldn't contain it. We just got to see pure elation. And Reece in the moment. I mean, that was obviously fantastic. Got us real hyped, and for good reason. So, all right, biggest shock of the season. I think this one will be interesting. Phil, I'm going to actually go right back to you on this one, because yours actually has nothing to do with the match of football being played.
It does not. It was the rather abrupt sale of David Luiz in preseason. Less than a month earlier, he'd signed a new 2-year contract, and everyone presumed that he was going to be the mainstay of Lampard's defence. And then things didn't quite go to plan in pre-season, and suddenly he was out the door joining Arsenal, and that all materialised over 48 to 72 hours. I think when all of us saw the initial rumours linking him with Arsenal, we sort of laughed it off, and then suddenly thought, hold on a minute, this is actually happening. Mm-hmm. And suddenly the face of Chelsea's defence changed, maybe for the better. The statistics may not back that up, but I think it was addition by subtraction in his case. I think as much as he might give you one game, he'll let you down for the next two. And it was more important that Lampard set the tone, that if somebody like Luiz was prepared to undermine him, it wasn't going to fly. And we saw that he meant business before a ball had been kicked in anger.
A ball kicked in anger. I love it, because you knew it was coming. you talk about critical moments for Frank Lampard in his first season. That is very much up there with them, without a doubt. Dan, why do you got to bring the mood down with your shock of the season? Come on, man.
Yeah, Dan.
Well, since playing in top flight football in the 2014-2015 season in Ligue 1, N'Golo Kanté had not played less matches than he did this season for Chelsea. He played 28 matches, 2,300 minutes. The lowest number before that was 38 at 3,200 minutes.
Jeez.
He has been a machine. He has been one of the most reliable players, most consistent players. His floor is higher than many people's ceiling. And to watch this season him struggle with injuries, to have to try to adapt to different positions, to be out for long stretches, was not something I was anticipating going into this season. I mean, we knew that he struggled a little bit at the tail end of last year, but, you know, kind of was amazing in our cup final and the winning the Europa League. I just wasn't expecting this. I really thought he would have been someone who would have almost week in, week out. He would have had Mason's role in my mind. He would have been in the team sheet every match almost, and to not have that was super weird. And I think was a real struggle for Frank too. I don't think Frank was expecting it either.
I appreciate Frank not running him into the ground like other managers though. So that was a win, but definitely something he had to deal with. You're losing your last world-class player to injury this season. I mean, he still had, 28 appearances, you said?
28 appearances, jeez, 3,200 minutes. Still scored 3 goals.
That Liverpool beauty. Whew.
We were there for that one, man. We almost rocketed into the stratosphere with that one.
Yeah. Nick, what about you for biggest shock of the season?
Yeah, I think just given his performance in the first half of the year, we touched on this a little bit in part one, which is, you know, for Kaio Tomori not really getting a chance the second half of the year with such inconsistency in the back line is pretty shocking to me, honestly. You know, clearly he made a few young player mistakes at the, you know, during the middle of the kind of run that he had. But to see Rudiger and Zuma and Christensen at the very least not be consistent, at the most struggle a lot of times this year, and to see, you know, a relatively above average performer in Tomori not really get a sniff is shocking to me. And I think it's something that, you know, I hope is figured out, because I really enjoyed watching him play the first part of the year.
Yeah, I think we're all kind of hoping something comes out on that. We get a little bit of a heads up, but I get it. Mine was Kepa. I did not see him being so bad this season. Like, he generally wasn't that bad for Sarri last season. Granted, he faced way fewer shots, and that could be part of it. But just lack of confidence, lack of ability, didn't mesh, whatever it was. I mean, he really, like, wasn't even at a competent level. Where you're like, well, okay, at least he's doing enough to get by. Like, to see him get that bad... And to see Willie kind of take over and be like, oh, geez, I guess Willie's our number one goalkeeper this season. Like, I just didn't expect him to be that bad. So it's a bad shock, not a good shock. But to be fair, the three of us all came with negative shocks. And Phil over here is Mr. Optimist and was like, no, here's a good thing that shocked me. So I guess that just says a lot about us and how we look at things. But the last one we have before we get into the season predictions was looking ahead. Who we think the next youth player will see in the first team next season based on what we saw in the 19-20 Premier League season. Obviously, Phil's going last. Duh. So I said Gilmore. Dan said whatever Phil says, which is like guessing.
The right answer. Duh.
$9.01 in Price is Right. So thank you for that. Nick, you had Tino Andrin. So... none of that matters because Phil, the expert, is here to tell us what the answer is.
Excellent. Thank you.
If we class Gilmore as having already made his first team breakthrough, then
yeah.
I think in terms of pure ability, you're looking at Tino Andrin or Conor Gallagher as being the closest to being ready to contribute. They both arguably could carve out a role in the squad next season, but the odds are in favor of one or both of them being on loan. And that's why it becomes interesting as to who breaks through from the players that don't go on loan. If you go back 12 months, the idea of Armando Broja making his first team debut this season would have been fanciful. It's to his credit that he had such a good season and he broke through. So you start to look at the players who are likely to feature most in the development squad next season. And somebody like Lewis Bate comes to mind. He was with the first team squad bubble after lockdown. He was on the bench at Sheffield United. He travelled with the squad to the FA Cup final. And he's a little bit like Gilmore. He's not quite the same sort of player. He's the left-footed equivalent. He's a little bit more aggressive with the way he plays and covers a lot of ground. But if he has a really good season for the development squad, he could definitely earn opportunities. And the compact schedule next season mm-hmm. means that some of the League Cup matches, for example, should be these opportunities for players to get a look. So Henry Lawrence could have a go, Daniel Simeu could have a look, Valentino Livramento, all of the boys who were with the first team bubble and got that 6 to 8 week window of training with the first team squad and building up trust and credit with Frank would probably be in line first for such opportunities in September and October.
Valentino Livramento is a hell of a name.
Just rolls off the tongue.
It really is. And you could also throw in the new boy, Mbuyamba, to that. That he's obviously got the physical credentials immediately. He's not the saviour that everyone seems to think he'll be based on the questionable standards of Chelsea's first team centre-halves this season. But he has all of the tools to make really, really quick progress through the ranks. He could handle his own in cup competitions. And as we've seen with Frank over the last year, if you impress and you have the right attitude in training, the opportunities will come your way. Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like Ampadu doesn't fit this question, or are we just overlooking him?
I think I'm expecting him to go back on loan, because if I admire his drive and determination to earn a place in the first team squad this season. But after a year at Leipzig where he didn't play, I don't think he can afford to have another year where he's a bit part player at best. And a lot depends on whether somebody like Declan Rice is signed or not as to how many opportunities Ampadu would get to play this season. But since he signed from Exeter, he's really not played that much meaningful football. So you're looking at this season, he'll be 20. He needs to get a lot of minutes under his belt to really start making progress and to recapture some of what he had. Because by no means was he bad for Leipzig last season. We saw him thrown into
Spurs
action away to Tottenham. Yeah, exactly. And he excelled in at centre-half. And I think he's a better midfielder than he is a centre-half. But he's very good at both. And you've got to pick your next move very carefully with him, because if you have three straight seasons of pretty much nothing, then you start to encroach on something like Loftus-Cheek territory. Now, Loftus-Cheek's absences have mostly been through injury, but he's 25 in January and is yet to reach 150 senior appearances, and you don't want that to happen to Ampadu.
Totally fair. All right. Well, those are the awards we have for this 19-20 season. We're going to take a real quick ad break. Thank you to the sponsor for supporting the show financially. When we're back, we're going to revisit our predictions from this season and see how good we were, because there's nothing that we're better at than predicting things that we have no idea what's going to happen. So we'll be right back. All right, so about a year ago, because that's how damn long this season was, we did predictions. We predicted a lot of things. And now we're going to find out how accurate we were. So these are Premier League predictions, so we should keep it simple, all right, before you statos come back at us and say, well, they did it. Well, we keep it simple. We just went Premier League. So the first one we predicted was that how many goals Chelsea would score. So the benchmark under Maurizio Sarri was 63 goals. So I predicted 60, Dan predicted 70, Nick predicted 63, and the total was 69. So, Dan, you went over, but we're closest. So I guess we chalk it up to you now.
But the hilarious part is coming.
Which is the lead, the goal scores. We're like, who are going to be the top three goal scorers? Phil, believe it or not, I guess Pedro, Barkley, and Giroud, because preseason was a humming at that point. Dan had Barkley, Tammy, and Pulisic, which actually wasn't that bad of a shout, which is super annoying. And then
2 out of 3.
Nick had Callum, Barkley, and Pedro. Boys, Pedro barely even featured He went out with a whimper.
That was a big fat zero that I just posted right there.
Yeah. In all reality, it was Tammy, William, and Pulisic as the top three goal scorers. Phil, we're just going to let you grade us on this. It's pretty poor with Dan being the standout in this category.
Dan had Abraham and Pulisic, so he wins, and I don't think there's very much to say about the others.
I really, really hope this streak ends right now, Dan, because the next one we had was total assists under Mitsu. Sorry, we had 52. We went with who was going to be the leading assisters. We had 46 this season. We had six less assists, which is not great. I had William and nobody because I'm dumb. I just was like, it's only going to be William. Dan had Mason Mount and Reece James leading the assists. And Nick had Pulisic and Giroux. But what was the answer? William.
I don't want to say it.
Yeah. Phil, aren't you proud of me?
I'm very proud. I'm just disappointed that none of you had assist Pilicueta.
Nick, it's really very, whose fault that is.
Very good shout, Phil. Well done. And thank you for using his God-given name.
His legal name?
Yeah.
His birth name. How many goals will Chelsea concede the next one? Conceded 39 under Mauricio Sarri. We conceded 54 this season. So mine is that terrible stat. I had 45, Dan with 36, Nick at 45. Gentlemen, the level of optimism blinded us. But to be fair, Phil, did you expect us to bleed goals in Frank's first season?
I didn't, and given that Kepa let a lot of things past him, I'm going to let this one pass for all of you guys.
Hey, I also would like to point out that Dan was nearly 20 goals off.
I like it.
Yeah, this was not a good one. Yeah, this was bad.
Yeah, you were feeling real confident. It's probably because David Luiz is still on the team at this time.
That's true.
Next one we had was how many clean sheets will Chelsea pick up? We had 14 under Mito Sarri. So I went 14 again. Dan feeling real strong with 17. Nick feeling real pessimistic at 12. And we got 9. So again, 9 clean sheets out of a 38-match season. Knowing that we had some pretty terrible teams in the league this season. And we fumbled that one. I mean, again, Phil, we can probably just point this all at Kepa and just move on and be done with it.
Yeah, I think that's safe. Otherwise, I might get in trouble and he might file a restraining order.
Yeah, if you didn't listen to the first season review, Phil had some amazing scores for some players. And Kepa's was a 0. No spoiler. So go back and listen to that. Most appearances. So this is where I'm just going to get it a little bit. I predicted David Luiz literally the next day he left for Arsenal. So, that was great. At least I lost early. Dan and Nick going with Kepa. Phil, you want to go ahead and let them know how off they were on that one?
Yeah. I kind of think it's almost cheating a little to pick the goalkeeper for the most appearances, because more often than not, that's going to be the case.
Unless
Mason Mount made the most appearances. He played in 37 or 38 league matches. If I'd have made the same predictions at that time, I probably would have been inclined to think that Kante would have played more than he did.
Yeah,
he's a very safe bet if fit. You can, like Dan said earlier, he would have played as often as Mount did, maybe more. But unfortunately, he missed pretty much half the season.
As P's the other cheat code on this one, usually. So, but I think we all felt like if Reece James was that serious of a contender for right back, that he may fall off a little bit from his normal.
He made 36, so he was right behind Mount.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's just nuts.
So this one was who will be Chelsea's player of the season. Obviously, we don't know the official one at this point. I had William. Dan had Mount. Nick had Pedro. Pedrito.
Man, what was I doing? God.
Was it the over the head kick, the back?
Yeah, I must have been riding high off that midair scorpion that he scored against Salzburg. God,
Phil, I mean, what? From a player of the season prediction standpoint, Dan sticking his neck out there for Mason Mount, and he wasn't that far off.
I have a feeling that Mount's going to win this. It's a public fan vote, and I don't think the football Twitter is representative of the entire fan base. So for everybody who might be inclined to vote Kovacic, and that's their prerogative, I think you'll find more people will side with Mount. So that looks like a pretty prescient shout from Dan.
Yeah, That's not helping the team chemistry. Who will be Chelsea's most improved player from season to season?
This is even worse.
Yeah, this is a bad one.
This is rough. This is very rough.
So we'll just get to it. I had Kovacic feeling real good about that. Dan had Callum Hudson-Odoi. Ooh, and Nick coming in hot with Emerson.
Oh my God, what was I doing?
Bill, I can't defend him, and I don't expect you to, but I'm just going to let you pile on a little bit.
You can't defend him, and Emerson can't defend. I think it's appropriate.
Oh my God.
Yeah, but much like my thoughts on Kepa, I think I should probably draw a line under them before I get in a bit of trouble. I think most improved player is arguably Mount. He had no previous Premier League experience and finished the season looking like one of the best players at the club.
But I think the other shout in my mind might have been Tammy, because this was his second go at being a Premier League striker. You know, the first loan on Swansea was a little rough, and this, you know, kind of showed that he was capable of being a top goal scorer for a top European club. So I think he's probably the other one. I think Callum is unfortunately disappointing that the injuries kind of took him so long to get back and find his way into the team. I really was hoping that he would be the one.
He was back. He was back early. I mean, he was back when we were there at the end of September. He just didn't feature a lot. So high hopes for the kid, though. Tell you what, high hopes. Kovacic wasn't terrible. I don't know. That's respectable. I'll take that. Here we go. What position do Chelsea finish in the league? And we have our top six predictions and who we relegated. So we're going to get through this because this is going to be fun. I guessed fourth, so you can PayPal me my earnings. Appreciate it. Dan had third, which was looking real good until the very end. Nick was sixth. And if you want to go back and listen to our prediction episode, it might sound really funny right now, now that you have all the answers in context. And not just picking on Nick, but all of us. I mean, Phil, you have Dan, who was the over-optimist. I was the neutral, and I think Nick the pessimist, as you'd assume, throughout this entire thing. And the position predictions stand by that.
Yeah, they do. And it was a matter of goal difference in the end. My predictions in the preseason were I had Chelsea finishing third as well. So I think being confident in qualifying for the Champions League was ultimately well placed. I can see why people would have been a little bit more cautious with a sixth place prediction from Nick. But the league played out like it played out. I don't think anyone expected Tottenham to be quite so bad this season, but that was a nice bonus.
Yeah.
Nice. I love that. A nice bonus. I think recanting my testimony at the beginning of the year, the fact that we lost Eden Hazard and couldn't really replace him was my, like, I think the where do the goals come from is my question. And I was pleasantly surprised they came from a lot of different places, although inconsistently.
Yeah. All right, top six predictions. So real quick, let me tell you what the top six were, the official table standings. Liverpool first, Manchester City second, Manchester United third, Chelsea fourth, Leicester City fifth, Tottenham Hotspur sixth. I had Manchester City, Liverpool, Tottenham, Chelsea, Arsenal, Leicester City. So I didn't have United anywhere in my top six. I did have Leicester, though, and Arsenal were wrongfully in there. And Tottenham just made it at the very end, as we said. Dan, I'll let you walk through yours top six.
City, Liverpool, Chelsea, United, Spurs, and Wolves. And with Leicester being, if I had Leicester in there, I would have like declared this as the ultimate victory over the both of you, but that was not the case.
So the victory not declared. Noted. Got it. Nick, what about you? This will be great.
I have to stop drinking before I do these, I think. Or I have to drink more. Either way, I was in that weird spot where I made another terrible batch of predictions here. City, and I denoted by 9 to 12 points.
Yeah, feeling real good about that one.
Oh, my God. And they only came in second by like 30 or 40 points. So, you know, sure. Liverpool second, United third, Arsenal fourth. Sure. Spurs fifth, and Chelsea sixth. Tough beat there.
Yay. Phil, it's like, even the way the season plays out, you can still have a pretty good idea who your top four are going to be, top six even. Obviously, I did chuck in Leicester, Dan threw in Wolves, Nick went with your traditional top six, but that didn't come to fruition. So, I mean, it's kind of you kind of predictable, but the positions within who's where clearly are not.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Dan did very well to get all four Champions League qualifiers spot on. Not in the right order, but I think Leicester were the surprise team to get into the top six, and Arsenal finishing way down in mid-table was probably the biggest upset from all of that. Although, again, Dan didn't have Arsenal in his top six, so where he actually predicted them to finish is only his guess. You can claim credit and say that you actually had them finishing ninth now if you'd like.
Yeah,
I totally had it ninth. Uh-huh. I'm surprised we cut... Where'd you cut off the rest of this, Nick?
Yeah, we gotta do full table next season. Full table.
You know, I think... You know, and it was real tight at the end. I mean, the amount of places Tottenham made up is actually kind of impressive. I didn't think they had it in them. Leicester were in third until right at the very end, and then they just fell. Wolves were right in it until the end too. I mean, it was one of the most chaotic, you know, ends of the season for obvious reasons, because not only was the top four a wild mess, because we also thought City were suspended, you know, because they broke rules, but then UEFA's like, wait, never mind, we don't know how to enforce our own rules, so joke on us. We thought they were out, so then you're gonna take top five. It was equally crazy down the relegation zone, which thankfully we really didn't pay attention to, minus, oh, do they have their backs against the wall at the end of the season? Are they gonna be putting up a fight? So for relegation, I had Newcastle, Brighton, and Sheffield United. So chalk that one up for all of us, because we all had them. Dan, who were your three?
I thought Southampton were going to go down finally, and Danny Ings decided to individually prove me wrong. Norwich, which did go down, and then Sheffield, which we all predicted, and that was a really bad beat.
Mm-hmm. Nick?
Yeah, I had Norwich City, and I think I got the rest right, so... I won this one.
Yeah.
No.
Brighton and Sheffield.
I had Brighton going down. And honestly, they're terrible. Sheffield United was the biggest shock of the season by a country mile. Mm-hmm. And credit to Chris Wilder. I mean, they certainly whooped up on us at the end.
Yeah, the official relegated teams were Bournemouth, Watford, Norwich City. Phil, I mean, you know, again, Sheffield in the European places right until the end. Newcastle somehow pulling, you know, looking actually pretty good after the break. Brighton just doing enough. Southampton actually looking really, really sharp all of a sudden under Hasenhüttl. But relegation's an absolute crapshoot. Like, some of these teams that are still in the Premier League, I'm so confused how. I don't get it.
Yeah, I was really surprised that Watford went down. I wasn't surprised that Sheffield United stayed up. I didn't have them in my predictions, but I definitely didn't have them finishing that high up the table. And I think there's a bunch of teams. Anyone in the bottom half this season could easily fall next season, because you tread water for so long and you can't break through to that next level. Like Bournemouth fan. Bournemouth invested a lot of money in their squad to try to make themselves a consistent top 10 to 12 team. And it's really, really hard to do that because there's so much money in the top half of the table. So I think it's entirely... I had Newcastle going down in my predictions, and I think Steve Bruce did a really good job to get out of it, given that he rarely had the backing of his own fans who were still harking back to wanting Benitez, and he outperformed them. So it's never easy to stay up in the Premier League. Credit to any manager who manages to achieve that. And... maybe Arsenal go down next season.
Wild.
Fingers crossed, baby. Absolute come on. Come on.
I mean, Southampton got pummeled 8-0 by Leicester and then turned their season around from that.
9-0.
You know, so they were expected to go down, turned it around. Newcastle.
Villa and Watford were in the last spot for a big part of the season, exactly. Too. I mean, we can't forget about that.
We gifted Bournemouth 4 points. We gave them 4 points and they still
tried to help
them.
Tried to actively help them.
Yeah, so Newcastle easily could have gone down. Palace could have gone down. Brighton, West Ham, Villa. All those teams were in and about it and right to the end. But the three worst teams, they fought their faces off to get down there. I mean, Norwich had 21 points. You guys remember the Pookie party at the beginning of the season? Yeah, that fiesta ended real quick. Watford had 34 points. Like, they won 8 matches out of 38. Norwich won 5. And Bournemouth had 34 points. They won 9 matches all season. Like, you talk about a shit season to watch at a fan. Could you imagine only winning 8 matches all season? Oh, it is some turgid football down there. They are so bad. But Villa, you know, just squeaking it out. West Ham, Brighton, same thing. I mean, there's somehow 6 points between Brighton in 15th and Bournemouth in 18th. 7 points. And I don't even know how they pulled it off. But, hey, guys, that's the season in a nutshell. I mean, Phil, your kind of overall reaction of this season, like, do you give it a great, a meh, or that was an ugly season? Like, what's your kind of overall feeling now that it's all wrapped?
I said at the start of part one of this that for Chelsea it was a work in progress, but as a season overall, I don't think it's anything like we'll ever see again. There was a 3-month absence right at the business end of the campaign. You come back, there's no fans in stadiums. You've got to fit 3 months of fixtures into a month and a half, and the physical demands on that, it just made it so unpredictable and so surreal that I think anyone who came out of it with credit should definitely deserves it. Just Lampard's in his first Premier League season. He's been a player for at that level for so long, but it's a different animal when you're coaching. And yeah, it's definitely a positive season for Chelsea. I think it's the building blocks and the foundations are starting to be put into place in certain areas. We know where the problems are. Lampard knows where the problems are, and hopefully it's the start of a long and successful story.
Agreed. I mean, for me, Dan, it's like the minimum level of acceptance. Context says it's Frank's first season. There was no transfer ban. We did enough to get top 4. But it's like, all right, here's the floor. We got to go from here. And, you know, knowing what we now know about the season, Phil's point, like, we even changed the rules for part of the season because it was that big of an anomaly, an outlier. At the end of the day, like, credit to Frank, we didn't win a trophy, but we got to a final and we got top 4. That objectively is a good season based on our circumstances.
Yeah, we were hand-tied a little bit around how much we were going to be able to do. I think the winning of an FA Cup would have been, you know, something that took this season to being like a, you know, I think Phil's point around we'll never see something like this again is absolutely accurate. It would have been another level of just incredible, you know, happenstance and fortunes if we had done the FA Cup as well. I think with the way that we're spending in Werner and Ziyech and potentially Havertz here, the expectation is going to be much higher next season. And I think we have a manager in place who knows that, who's communicating that and is setting the appropriate bar, Nick. So yeah, we have a season that starts in less than a month and I am so ready for it.
Yeah. Inject it in my veins. I'm going to look back on this season incredibly fondly. I think when it's all said and done, I'll never forget the energy of being at the Bridge against Liverpool, all those young guys starting and going toe to toe with them and probably deserving more than what we got out of that game. To see Frank's first win in person at the Bridge, incredible. And, you know, just to be along the ride with everybody who listens to the show. I mean, we try and do our best to remain calm throughout the year. We try and do our best to not go too high or too low, but damn it if there weren't points this year where we had to, you know, and that is part of being a football fan. You know, it's part of the great part of this journey is just understanding those kind of key inflection points. So really proud of the team, really proud of the effort that was involved from everybody, and thank you for listening to about the 190th episode of this season's podcast list.
It keeps on growing every time you mention a number.
574.
Exponentially. Yeah. Cool. Well, Phil, thanks for hanging out with us, making time again for part 2. Really appreciate it. You're an expert in your field, and we love having you share the knowledge with us. So thanks, sir.
Thank you for having me, not just for this one, but throughout the whole season. It's been a really fun experience, and I'm looking forward to spending more time talking to you guys next season.
Awesome. Well, we'd love to have that. Listeners, you're the best out there. Thanks for listening to us. You got two long episodes back to back, but there's a lot to talk about. So hopefully you enjoyed it. Let us know who you picked for all those awards. We'd love to debate and have fun conversations about it. Best place to do it is our Discord on Patreon. But that's going to wrap us up. So until next time, Chelsea fans, you know what to do. Keep the blue flag flying high.